You're listening to the Myth Cream Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Mike Hernandez, and Chris Winkle.
There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. 'Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode is brought to you by our patrons, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek, and Ari Ashkenazi.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Myth Creates Podcast. I'm Oren. With me today is...
Chris.
And for the third time, because I can't get him out of the podcast, is Graham.
Yes.
He says, once you get your evil twin in here, he just will not leave.
It's true. It's true. I will not depart from Oren, and I hope to drag him down to his doom after this podcast.
That's reasonable.
You probably won't hear him for another several podcasts after this.
I think that's okay as long as we, like, learn a lesson along the way.
Yeah, a good message, you might say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This podcast definitely has something to say, which is good, because that's our topic for this week, is we are doing part two of our sci-fi films with something to say, because we did that a couple weeks ago, and we did not nearly get through our list.
It turns out there are a lot of sci-fi films with something to say.
So first, I want to give Graham a chance to talk about one of his. I know he's immediately going to cheat and bring up a fantasy film, but that's okay, because he's evil.
Well, the one I'm going to bring up is one which has, I think, a weaker message than some of the others, but the Harry Potter series, where the underlying moral is, don't bully kids, or you will cause people to become murderers. You will notice
that does happen a lot.
I think that's the root of literally every villain in Harry Potter.
Well, I don't know about every villain, but the two ones that come to mind are, like, you know, Snape and Voldemort, right? And people are going to yell at me for calling Snape a villain.
He is, though, most of the series.
But both of them do terrible things, and their reasoning is that they, and, like, the explanation of why is that they were, like, bullied in school, right?
And really, I think you could count Malfoy, because, I mean, Harry and his friends do give the Slytherins back as much as they get.
That's true, although Malfoy is clearly instigating that, right? Like, they don't ever seek Malfoy out and, like, give him a hard time, right?
not really. But, I mean, there is sort of this partisan, like, thing where they fight all the time and then they don't get anything done.
Well, there is that weird, like, dividing the school into houses thing, which has its own, like, messaging. But it is pretty clear that Slytherin is the house of evil people, right? Like, not everyone from Slytherin is evil, but nearly everyone evil is from Slytherin.
Yeah.
You know, the percentages are just so high that, like, in the real world, it would be immediately shut down.
I don't know if you guys remember, because it was a while ago now, but when the Harry Potter books were really popular, but before the movies came out, there were a lot of people who were, like, trying to ban them. Particularly people who were sort of Christians who felt like it was advocating witchcraft. But then after the movie came out, these people who wouldn't, like, read the book, you know, went and saw the movie because it only took 2 hours of their time. And they're like, oh, this movie advocates for, like, love and not against evil. And, like, that really got rid of a lot of the hatred and the trying to ban the books. That Furry was like, well, of course, it's a standard, but, like, it wouldn't be a popular book if it wasn't, like, against evil and for good.
Is there a chick track for Harry Potter, though? Like, there must be one somewhere, right?
I don't think there was one that specifically addressed it. And unfortunately, there will never be one again, because that guy's dead.
Yeah, he's not around anymore. But Harry Potter definitely does have an anti-bullying message. I think that's true. I think it also has a message about how easily a society can be overtaken by its worst elements when people don't do enough, which is particularly resounding now for reasons that I won't get into on a podcast because I don't want to be depressed.
Too late.
But certainly the showing that the takeover of the Ministry of Magic and the number of people who are just like, hey, everybody's afraid, so they just cooperate.
Right. And, like, you know, like, people who aren't necessarily evil, but don't do what's necessary to prevent Voldemort from rising because they're trying to cover their own ass, right? Like, that's basically the Fudge, I think is his name, is the chief minister. Yeah, that's basically his entire character.
That actually might be a good place to segue into a sci-fi film that I can bring up.
Ooh, actual sci-fi film.
That I can bring up to assuage my sin, unless it was brought up on part one. I hope not. Which is District 9, that kind of shows a society in the midst of, like, the ministry has already been taken over, essentially, and now discrimination is the order of the day. And I thought District 9, Orin, and I famously disagree on this, but I thought it really effectively showed how horrifying, you know, the horrifying consequences of discrimination and, like, anti-immigrant policies and all of this. Because if you treat people as less than human, they go through this terrible, terrible situation. And, like, then you see through the eyes of Vicus, who originally didn't care about the prawns and thought they were basically expendable. He's forced to understand their living situation, and he's like, this is horrifying. We can't treat anyone like this. Unfortunately, now I am one of them, so I have to be treated like this.
So I agree that that is definitely the intent of District 9. I do not think that its execution is particularly good for a number of reasons. If for no other reason than all of the things that people say about the aliens, all of the like stereotypes that people give them, it are shown to be right. Like the aliens are shown to be pretty mindless in the movie, with the exception of, for some reason, the main character alien, who we know is different from the other aliens because he wears clothes. And that's clearly like a just a visual thing so that we can try to tell him apart. But it does have its own message, right? Is that he is conformed more than the others. And so he's the main character that we have.
I got the idea that it was sort of supposed to be like symbolic of lost hope, whereas I think Christopher Johnson was his name, had not given up all hope. And like the movie explanation was that they had like sort of this mental circuit in their brains that was shut down when they lost contact with the spacecraft. And then once they reactivate the spacecraft properly, the aliens get back their smarts again. But it kind of was like that. I felt it was like a metaphor for like they'd been ground down so much and they were now like addicted to cat food drug and all that, that they couldn't really act, you know, with agency for themselves.
So can I ask a question? So since I have not seen District 9, are these like, from what I understand it, it's a bunch of aliens that are sort of put together in a camp where they and treated very poorly. Is that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so these aliens, do they seem like, do they have, like, it's weird to say this, but do they have, like, humanity? Do they seem like sympathetic human-like characters, or do they not seem like that?
I felt like they did.
Well, that's sort of my problem with it, is that I feel like one of them does, but I felt like the others were, like, I think that the movie needed more time developing the aliens. Because, like, when we saw them, they just seemed to be very, you know, like, the whole idea, the whole stereotypes of them was that they were stupid and that they, like, you know, weren't intelligent. And they did have an explanation for that, but it still turned out to be true.
I think they could have developed it better, yeah.
And it was unclear why one of them was immune to that effect, right? Like, there was the one who was the main character, or he's not really the main character, the main character is a human, but the alien who gets the most screen time. Who is also the most human-like.
Yeah, there were some things they could have done better.
So here's the thing that what I heard about District 9 is that these aliens are supposed to be like a parallel for humans that are treated bad, and that some of the, for instance, I don't know if it was directly the shot or just quotes that they had in the movie were actually directly from people, things that people had said about immigrants.
Yeah.
And they used them in the movie. And I have to say that if I were to build a story about humans who are mistreated and try to show why that is wrong, representing those humans who are being mistreated as aliens is kind of the opposite of what I would do. Like, it's like wanting to not have you compare, you know, it's, we all know it's degrading, for instance, to compare any group of humans to dogs.
Yeah.
So would you make a movie where those humans are dogs and everybody else is a human? And immigrants are often called illegal aliens.
Yeah.
So making them literal aliens, like, they're just so, like, it's a very questionable choice. I feel like it would have felt a lot more appropriate if the movie had been about humans being immigrants to an alien planet who were kept in the camp there, right? And the aliens were very like, what are these undocumented immigrants doing? Or, you know, like that.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the movie, but like that seems like a very odd way to build an analogy.
I don't think you're wrong. I think that that makes a good point. It doesn't capture everything that I had that was an issue with the film, but I also agree with Graham that I agree that that's what the film is trying to do. My issue isn't with its intent. I just have issue with its execution.
I would agree. I would argue that I think the alien message, if it had been carried out a little bit better, I give a lot of credit to how it was carried out, but I do think that there were some flaws, as Oren says, and that one of them was that they should have illustrated more of the humanity of the aliens, essentially. They should have shown them as more people and less these weird drones. That was, like, the part that bothered me the most about the movie. But I think that if they'd carried it off with a little bit more respect for the aliens' similarity to humanity, it could have been even more powerful than it was. And it was pretty powerful to watch, at least for me.
The thing that really bothered me about it was that they had scenes in the preview that were really poignant scenes that are not in the movie.
That was also a problem.
Like, there is this really poignant scene in the preview where, like, some government officials are, like, interviewing an alien and, like, demanding to know, what do you want? Why did you come to Earth? Are you going to take our stuff? And the alien, like, says, we just want to go home. And it's, like, a really poignant scene. It's A, not in the movie. B, also not really what the movie's about. So it was, like, it was very frustrating that I felt like I got drawn in by that. A much lighter movie that we can all point at and kind of laugh at its message, because it definitely has one, is Star Trek Insurrection.
Yep.
I don't think Chris has seen this one.
I actually haven't seen this one, but I know it's bad.
It's been a while. I think I saw it a long time ago, but it's been a while.
Okay, so this movie has a lot of weirdness going on, but the basic premise is that the Enterprise goes to this planet where there are these people who have rejected technology and are immortal because they live on a planet with, like, immortality radiation somehow. And they are using, you know, really 1600s era tech, right? Like, they got, like, a blacksmith and, like, you know, some horse-drawn plows, and that's, like, the extent of their technology. Except for this giant dam. They have a giant dam, and I'm not sure how they built that.
They built it like they built the pyramids.
Maybe. And so, like, and the movie spends a huge amount of time talking up this lifestyle of living without any technology, of this slower pace of life where you have time to enjoy things, and, like, they have this moment where they're, like, looking at these quilts, and they're like, our artisans each spend, like, 10 years making one quilt.
That doesn't sound like you have a lot of time.
Well, the idea is supposed to be that their life is so slow that they can take their time and do whatever they feel like, right? They don't, you know, it's clearly playing off the fact that people feel stressed in their lives. But the thing that people don't understand is that everyone has always felt stressed at all times.
Yep.
Like, you know, like I find it's very unlikely that you can find any point in history where people didn't feel like they didn't like they had a, like where people felt like they had enough time in the day to do everything they wanted to do, right?
Yeah.
It's just that now we feel that way and are surrounded by technology. So when a movie comes along that says it's the technology's fault that you feel that way, that kind of resonates with us, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this movie, of course, it leaves out how hard the work is when you're, you know, living on subsistence farming, which is what they're doing.
This seems to be that's kind of a trend in Star Trek, though, isn't it?
It really is, of, like, glorifying the life that has where you reject all your technology and just live simply. And it's like that living simply is not simple. Anyone who's ever actually tried that can tell you that it's very hard.
Yeah. Not to mention all the people who would, like, die from diseases.
Right.
Yeah.
That too.
Or injuries modern technology.
Right. That's assuming that you are a able-bodied and healthy and will never have to give birth to a child. You know, this, like, all of those things are kind of wrapped into this idea of this superior, natural, with quotation marks around it, life. And there's other messages going on in Insurrection that are not problematic. I would, like, you know, there's the message that, like, you shouldn't like, force a small population off of their land to benefit a large population. And like, yeah, okay, that's definitely a lesson that we could do to learn as humans. Fair enough. But that particular one, that, like, back-to-nature message is just kind of ridiculous.
Speaking of the, like, weird glorification of nature, can we talk about Jurassic Park?
Oh, please.
That was not where I thought we were going, but we can.
I want to talk about Jurassic Park.
Genetic engineering is so bad, guys! It's the worst!
Wait, Chris, I think it's The Podcast Finds a Way to get to Jurassic Park.
Nice. The podcast finds a way.
Yeah. Well, obviously Jurassic Park is scary in some portions and has a lot of tension. And I think part of the reason why it's weird is it has a trope that is normally used in horror, which is the whole idea of you have a scientist who has defied nature, done something unnatural.
He's gone too far.
Humans shouldn't have done that. And then the scientist has to be like punished and... You know, it's this karmic thing, which honestly horror could use less of, just because, you know, scientific innovations are not a sin that we should be avoiding.
You just say that because you want to go too far.
But yeah, so it has this whole idea of like, you know, should we be playing with nature by like making dinosaurs and like it'll get out of hand and there's no way we can predict what will happen. And
the problem with that is that if the systems had worked as they were intended to and someone hadn't sabotaged them in every Jurassic Park book or movie, the dinosaurs would have been fine. And it shows that dinosaurs being back is actually, in a controlled environment, pretty sweet.
Dinosaurs don't kill people. Humans kill people.
It's like, argument one, dinosaurs are sweet. Argument two, security systems might fail. So, I mean, which is better? I would argue if you can bring back dinosaurs are sweet enough that, you know, maybe some people die on an island sometime. Who cares?
Yeah, and it's like, okay, so the movie really wants the stakes to be much higher than they are, right? Like, because the actual stakes of the movie are, well, all of our security systems all failed, and honestly, we should have been under review anyway, because the movie starts with a guy dying because their security precautions weren't sufficient, and... The movie, everyone is like looking at the lawyer being like, why do you care that a guy died? Like, why are you trying to shut down this beautiful dream just because a man was brutally killed? Which is funny.
Then later the lawyer's like, oh my God, we have to save this place. It will make all the money. All the money.
Right. So, but like the actual stakes are that some people in a zoo might die. And like, those are fine stakes, but the movie wants them to be higher, right? The movie wants to portray dinosaurs as like, some grand threat to humans, like, you know, like dinosaurs are gonna get out and like organize an army and overthrow humans and like, you know, instate, you know, Tyrannosaurus Rex as president.
Hilariously, this is actually way worse in the book. Like, the book goes even further with this because Michael Crichton is super anti-science.
Oh,
and like, this is such a silly concept because it's like, okay, like, worst case scenario, the dinosaurs get out and some people in the park die. But, like, you know how you could prevent that? We have these things called machine guns. Like, they're just animals, okay? Dinosaurs are just...
They can't shoot dinosaurs, Orin, or don't be crazy.
Dinosaurs are just big animals. They're not monsters.
It's not like in all the Jurassic Park media, they use tranquilizer darts to, like, shut them down all the time.
See, now I'm imagining, like, Jurassic Park, you know, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger with, like, with, like, a machine gun and, like, yeah. Like,
it's about 15 minutes just raptors exploding.
you joke, but that is definitely the plot of at least 5 video games.
Yeah.
It's true. It's true.
And it's, like, dinosaurs, the idea, like, the whole, like, life, like, finds a way thing is, like, like, honestly, he makes a big deal about, well, the dinosaurs started breeding, and it's like, okay, but, like, the only... Why does that matter? Like, even in the context of the movie, that doesn't matter.
You can't control life, man!
Like, it doesn't put them in any greater danger, because even if the dinosaurs breed, like, what, are we gonna wait around in this island for 20 years for the dinosaurs to get bigger? You know, for the baby dinosaurs to grow up, right?
I mean, and then later in Jurassic World, it's shown that I think they can still breed there, and they're fine. like the dinosaurs breed and it's like, oh, there's dinosaurs more. And the only reason that there's a threat in Jurassic World is people decide to engineer an even scarier dinosaur because people aren't excited enough by regular dinosaurs anymore. So it's like,
right.
You went too far the first time and it was actually okay. So let's go too far again.
And it's like, I think the implication is supposed to be that, like, well, the dinosaurs can breed now, so their numbers will increase and they'll overrun the Earth. And it's like, no, they won't, because we have tanks. Like, have you ever tried to bite a tank? It's not going to go very well for you, even if you have really big jaws. We also have planes and like missiles and stuff. Don't worry, it's fine. Guys, humans, just a message to all of humans, we can take dinosaurs in a fight. It's not going to be a much of a contest.
This is actually why I really liked the second movie. Everyone kind of disses on the second movie, and there were some problems with the second movie, like velociraptors who were established previously to be super smart and cool were suddenly really idiots the whole time. But the second movie does, I think, a decent job of building this world where there's just these five islands like off the coast of Costa Rica, and people have to deal with dinosaurs now. And it's mostly dangerous to fishermen and tourists who get too close to these islands and aren't ready to deal with dinosaur. Because they go over to the island and they're like, someone gets eaten and they're like, oh, there's dinosaurs. It's a problem.
Which can happen without dinosaurs, right? Like, yeah. You know, people who wander into the wilderness they're not prepared for die all the time without anything as fancy as a T-Rex, right?
Yeah.
That's just a thing that happens. Although Jurassic World also has the weird thing of the T-Rex that was able to somehow kill the crew of a ship that it was inside the hold of.
Because
they take the T-Rex from the island to L.A., right? But they wanted to have the T-Rex rampage around L.A. So the way that they did that was the boat pulls up into the pier and like just like instead of stopping, just like runs around.
Yeah.
And everyone on board is dead. Even the people who were up on the bridge and on the deck are all dead.
How did you manage that? And that was the Lost World, not a Jurassic World, just to end confusion.
Right, that was the second one. That was Lost World. And it's like, how did the T-Rex, which was inside the ship,
into the T-Rex's mouth? Was that what was going on there? Maybe some of the compies got on and ate everybody and then jumped into the water and died?
It's especially funny because the T-Rex just isn't very maneuverable, right?
Like, no. So the explanation was supposed to be, and this was ended up getting cut from the film for some reason. The explanation was supposed to be that some velociraptors had like snuck onto the ship and killed everyone, which is like, I mean, that's not no explanation, but that's an explanation that like requires you to imagine that the velociraptors are like trying to actively plot to get a T-Rex into LA.
Also that it would require showing the velociraptors who were never shown in that last part.
Yeah, so like that was all cut from the film and there were no velociraptors. So anyway, that's not part of the message. That's just a stupid plot issue.
Anyway, we have to stop dissing on Jurassic Park. We'll use all our time.
Should we talk about a good movie for a while?
Yeah, let's do that.
I know, Oren, you have seen Moon. Have you seen Moon, Graham?
I have not, but I've heard a lot of good things. And I want to see Moon.
Yeah, Moon's great.
So, yeah, Moon is an independent film that is just absolutely fantastic. And I really feel like it has this very strong message just about the value of human life in any form. Because it has, you know, okay, gonna have to go into a little spoilers, unfortunately, for this. But it has humans that turn out to be clones designed to live very short lives. Like,
yeah.
4 years. And
yeah.
Every single one of them is sort of thinks that they are the specific person that they were cloned from and has their memories and is tricked into thinking that they, from their moon base, are actually sending messages, you know, to their family. And so they think that they have a much larger lifespan than they actually do. And they are, but then they expire and were replaced so that they never know that their life is a fake. And, you know, it's tragic, but it ends with like a kind of a hopeful message of them, you know, a clone finally managing to try to get the word out and trying to save the clone that is dying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The point being that all of these clones that are just being stored as replacements are all like valuable human beings that should be treated better. Another cool thing about the film is that it has a robot that is good. Like, there's a robot.
It's a helpful robot.
Yeah, and you think this robot is, like, has enough mannerisms that you kind of wonder, is this going to be, like, an evil robot? And the robot, it's like an assistant on the base, and it's the only company that the clones have. But no, the robot really cares about the clones, too, you know?
Aww.
So that's, it's just a very, like, sort of, it's very, like, bittersweet ending, but, like, it has a very kind of, like, positive message.
I also think another message you could take from Moon is more specific even than the every human life has value, is the idea that you shouldn't create life if you cannot provide for it.
Yeah.
I would argue that creating a clone to only live 4 years, even if you treated it very well for those 4 years, I feel like that would be an inherently immoral act. And I think that the movie, you know, is at least somewhat about that, is like the idea that like you have a responsibility to life that you create, right? And I mean, you could apply that to parenting, honestly. But like anything that you bring into the world is somewhat your responsibility, and so you can't just, you know, create something to serve your purposes and then just like let it expire, right? Like you owe it to whatever you create to be better than that. And I think you can get that. I think that's a message that comes out of the movie. The movie's also just really, really good at building suspense, and is just I think a really good thriller film as well. Graham, do you have another one that you want to bring up?
I'll bring up, since we're going with movies that are good and fun, WALL-E, because that's
WALL-E.
That's there in the show notes, and it's a great movie, and it has a couple messages, and one of them is the very obvious, you know, on the face of it message of, please try and take better care of the environment, or our planet really will look like this, and WALL-E will have to go around making garbage cubes, and that will suck. And there's no guarantee that we'll get a cool spaceship to fly away and send Eve to meet him and cause a love story. And then the other one, which I think Orin and I may tussle on, as is
ooh,
proper.
Tussle time.
Is
time to
that,
tussle.
It's better to live and have some risk involved in your life and try and accomplish things than to just exist and not really have any meaning besides what's constructed for you by propaganda and not really feel anything and just float around on couches all day.
Okay, all right, I'm going to fight you, all right? Are you prepared to be fought?
I am prepared to be fought.
okay, so I enjoyed WALL-E as much as the next viewer, right? Like, I liked it, I liked the love story. I am prepared to completely trash the planet if it makes the WALL-E Eve story, like, more likely, you know? There's a thing. But the secondary message of the whole, like, I don't want to survive, I want to live, like, okay, yes. It is definitely not, you know, it is not sufficient to simply receive the nutrients that you need in order to not die, right? You need more than that in order for your life to be fulfilling. I don't think that's a particularly contentious point. But I would argue that the way that WALL-E portrays it is flawed, because the ship that they all live on is basically a utopia. Somehow, I don't know how they did this. This is kind of clashes with the message of the film, but somehow they have created a perfectly efficient system that can provide for everybody within it forever. Even though in the premise of this is that everyone was dying because they had too much trash. So I don't know how that works.
They had to figure out really good recycling systems in space.
So they have this paradise ship. And of course, the movie sets it up so that they all look very unappealing and like are not, and we don't, and all we do is see them sit there because we're the outside viewer. But I feel like that's like, there's no reason they had to be like that, right? Like they could just as easily have lived in this paradise and had been perfectly happy and had perfectly fulfilled lives. And I think that the movie used a dirty trick by making them all look the way that they did, because it knows that we will associate that negatively, even though there's not actually anything wrong being overweight, but it knows that we inherently associate that.
Yeah, I'll give you that. It did use kind of a trick, but I thought it was effective in how it showed that most of what they were doing was just receiving stimuli and not really interacting with the world around them or even the ship around them. Like, the captain interacted with the ship more than other people, but even he was, like, listless and bored and...
But, like, the issue, I think, is that it assumes that's what humans will do when all of their needs are met. And
that's
I would argue the evidence is actually the opposite. I would argue that when our basic needs are met, that gives us more time to do cool stuff, not less, right? Like, yeah. You know, if you don't have to work a 9-to-5 job that you hate, you are much more likely to be able to create something beautiful and meaningful to you. And when it comes down to it, that's kind of what matters, because a lot of it's arbitrary anyway. And I feel like telling someone if someone else's idea of being fulfilled is sitting on the couch playing video games all day, if they're not hurting anybody else, I really think it's not my place to tell them, no, you're doing it wrong. You need to go, like, build a boat or something.
Damn it. I think you're winning this one.
I fight you, Greb. You're my evil twin. I'm gonna go for the knockout.
No, you won! You beat me.
I'd also just like to point out that if you've ever met, like, number of retired people, you know, they usually are very busy. Yeah, they go and volunteer at places and keep themselves busy doing lots of things. You know, I would never judge somebody. You know, if you were, like, very heavy and you spent all of your day on chair and you interacted all, you know, online, but you were, like, happy and healthy, I don't feel like there's anything to complain about there. At the same time, I think the basic human nature is to keep ourselves busy. And there's a lot of people who would actually like to do a lot of cool hobbies, but find themselves exhausted and worn out after a day of regular work and then have to sit and veg because they've exhausted themselves. But, like, people who, you know, if we had something like universal basic, you know, minimum income or something like that, and people were not working, I don't think it's within human nature for most people to be idle. Like, I think people like to do things.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think I got bamboozled by Wally's positive message into accepting its negative connotations.
It's also just an adorable film. I mean, you know, it's not your fault, Graham. They're very good at tricking you into accepting this. Also, I was a little bit weirded out by the insistence that we have to return to Earth, because, I mean, Earth is a planet. Earth is a chunk of rock, like, with a lot of weird minerals on it. I don't think Earth is valuable because of its planet status.
Well, I think there's sort of a natural inclination to want to return to your home world. It's tied up in, like, the human concept of having a home.
Well, I'll get back to you when we are a spacefaring society, and we'll see if people actually have that. I know sci-fi assumes we have that. I'm not convinced.
Well, to be fair, the inclination of going back home was partly that, you know, the captain saw all of these images of what, like, humans used to have on Earth and found that very compelling. Right? So
right.
I think the idea was that they were missing an opportunity that they did not know that they had that existed on the planet, and that was sort of the thing that brought them home. Personally, I would say for the hunk of rock thing, in Wally, we don't really know exactly how much wildlife is left.
That's true.
I mean, he finds a plant, a single plant, but, like, you know, there's a question of, like, responsibility to other life forms and restoring it, because humans are not the only things that live there. If it was a hunk of rock where it had nothing but garbage and we'd really killed all other life on Earth, then, like, I feel that substantially reduces the value of the planet to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was certainly the impression I got, was that Earth was basically cockroaches in that one plant, right? Like, maybe that's not true.
Earth and Wally was not the most attractive place, but I think we might even be able to have another podcast about the urge to return home. I think that's a pretty deep-seated... That's a pretty deep-seated theme in literature, is that people want to have a home, and if they're taken away from it, there's, as old as the Odyssey, tales of returning home.
Unless you have a fungus in your brain that makes you go out and leave your home and explore, right?
It's true.
That's perfect. All right, well, maybe we'll get you back for that discussion later, but because right now we are out of time. Thank you very much, Graham, for joining us once again.
Welcome, welcome. I will crush you eventually, Oren.
Eventually. Your goatee is strong. This is a known fact. So to anyone listening at home, if anything that we said piqued your interest, feel free to email us at podcast@mythcranes.com. Otherwise, we will see you next week.
There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself.
You can subscribe to the MythCreant podcast through Stitcher, iTunes Radio, or find us at mythcreants.com. Opening and closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.